Lecture 12. Where is American English headed?
Like America itself, American English has had a colorful history. It was born of various sources: British English dialects, dialect mixing, and contact between English and an array of other languages, Native American, Western, Northern, and Eastern European, and West African. It had its growing pains. American English was disparaged when it first began to be noticed as an entity separate from British English. And for generations, English speakers in America oriented toward British norms, not American ways of speaking. American English and its speakers could also be cruel. English wiped out hundreds of Native American languages in the U.S. and suppressed generation after generation of immigrant languages. At the same time, American English has always been imaginative, expressive, and overall pretty democratic. The United States of America doesn't have an official language, and we don't have a language academy that dictates our standards. Our literary heroes are down to earth, and they celebrate the language of everyday life. And though many non-standard American dialects have been unfairly stigmatized, in the long run, Americans like their dialects. We recognize them as symbols of cultural history and as expressions of personal, interpersonal, and group identity. In fact, over the course of the 20th century and into the 21st, dialect variation in the U.S. has actually been increasing, not decreasing. Now, this may seem unexpected, given people's increasing mobility, intercommunication, and internet access. But if you think about it, it makes sense. America firmly established itself as a major player on the world stage over the past century and a half, and Americans became increasingly self-confident. The U.S. acquired Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines in the early 20th century. And as the century unfolded, America helped determine the outcomes of two world wars. As its global position and sense of national identity became increasingly secure, America could focus more on its internal diversity. It had always been there, but now it could shine forth. Minority groups who fought in World War II came home with a heightened sense of their value to the U.S., and the civil rights movement of the 1960s further bolstered a growing belief in the value of all of America's various cultural groups. And what's one of the strongest, most recognizable symbols of cultural identity? Language, of course. So as each of America's myriad cultures increasingly asserted their own unique identity, they also asserted their language varieties, their heritage languages, their second language varieties of English, and the natively spoken American English dialects associated with regional, ethnic, and community identities. In linguist Edgar Schneider's terms, the 20th century marked the differentiation stage of American English, the phase characterized by the recognition and celebration of internal linguistic diversity. So, in what ways have American English dialects been diversifying? Let's think first about regional dialects. Sociolinguists William LaBeouf, Sharon Ash, and Charles Boberg conducted a wide survey published as the Atlas of North American English in 2006. They were interested in all levels of language variation: lexical, phonological, and grammatical. But their chief focus was phonology, pronunciation systems, in particular, the pronunciation systems of vowels. So what exactly is a vowel system? We all know there's a difference between vowels and consonants, but do we really know what the difference actually is? Well, it has to do with how the sounds are produced. Consonants involve closure, the blockage or restriction of airflow. This happens somewhere in the vocal tract for some short period of time to some degree. For example, the T sound. It involves a brief blockage of the air with the tip of the tongue near the front of the mouth, on the ridge at the top, just behind the front teeth, ta. The K sound involves blockage at the back of the mouth. And some consonants allow some air to escape. For example, F and S, fa and sa. The closure can happen at any point, lips and teeth in the case of fa, and the tongue in the case of sa, ta, and ka. Consonants can also be either voiced or unvoiced, a technical distinction which has to do with whether or not the vocal cords are vibrating during the production of the sound. The consonants I mentioned so far are unvoiced or voiceless. The vocal cords don't vibrate. Some of the voiced consonants of English are D, G, V, and Z, or D, G, V, Z. But with vowel sounds like A, E, I, O, U, there's no closure. The different pronunciations depend on the position of the tongue within an open mouth. Now, you may think that some people have big mouths, but relatively speaking, our mouths are pretty small. And there's only so much room to manipulate the tongue without blocking airflow. So vowel space is limited. That means vowels have to be part of a coherent vowel system, or we run the risk of running our vowels into one another and causing confusion. Even a renowned sociolinguist like Bill LaBeouf can get confused. He has anecdotes about confusing the word copy, as in photocopy, with coffee. This is because vowels sometimes do run together in a process known as merger. There's a widespread vowel merger actually in progress in American English, even as we speak. How do you pronounce the vowels in the words copy and coffee? The same or different? More and more people are pronouncing them the same. They're merging them together. But as a rule, we try to avoid potential meaning confusion when we talk. So we have a strategy for coping when one vowel sound encroaches on the vowel space of another. And this is what linguists call vowel shift. When one vowel begins to change in pronunciation, for whatever reason, ease of pronunciation, linguistic fashion, other vowels may be pushed or pulled out of the way to keep vowels from collapsing together. This is what's known as a chain shift. Vowel shifts are not uncommon. English, as we know it today, was radically altered in the course of its history by a sweeping pronunciation change affecting all of its long vowels, the so-called Great English Vowel Shift. This took place sometime between 1350 and 1700, so over the course of centuries. It's essentially what changed Middle English, the language of Chaucer's day, into early modern English, which in turn became today's modern English. The Great Vowel Shift is also why a lot of English spellings don't match their pronunciations. Many English spellings were fixed before or during the vowel shift and were never changed to reflect the later pronunciations. Did you ever wonder why a word like boot is spelled with two O's but pronounced with oo? It turns out that pre-Great Vowel Shift, boot, used to be pronounced as bot with an O, not boot with an oo. The Great Vowel Shift also affected, some might say messed up, the pronunciation of EA sequences. Why are they sometimes pronounced as E, as in meet and beat, and sometimes as A, as in great or steak? Before the Great Vowel Shift, words with EA were pronounced with A, so great, steak, and so on. But then many EA words, but not all, shifted to E, so meet, beat, seat, cheat. And so did words with double E. So B-E-E-T, the vegetable, used to be pronounced as bait, and now it's beat, just like B-E-A-T. Essentially, what happened is that O words took over OO territory. B-O-O-T, boat, became boot, and A words took over E words. B-E-E-T, bait, became beat. But what happened to the original OO and E words? Well, hoose became house, and team became time. Interestingly enough, you can still hear the old oo as a relic feature in parts of the northern British Isles, where house is still a hoose. There's more to the Great Vowel Shift than that, but that's probably enough detail for now. Suffice it to say that radical changes in vowel systems have occurred before, and in the development of American regional dialects, vowel shifts are where the action is today. The Atlas of North American English identifies three major long-standing dialect regions in the eastern part of the U.S., the North, the South, and the Midland. The North and the South each have their own separate vowel systems, and they've actually shifted away from each other in recent decades. The vowel shift affecting the North is called the Northern Cities Vowel Shift. Its first seeds were probably sown with the construction of the Erie Canal in the early 1800s. Which brought an influx of people and dialects into Western New England and the Great Lakes area. Sociolinguists began noticing the Northern Cities vowel shift in the 1960s, and they've been tracking its progress ever since. The shift took root first in larger metropolitan areas, hence the name. From there, it spread into less densely populated communities. Today, the Northern Cities Shift area starts in western New England, proceeds into upstate New York, then through the extreme northern portions of Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, and then into Michigan and Wisconsin. So essentially, the Great Lakes area, or what the Atlas terms the Inland Northern Dialect region. The shift has also recently spread into Illinois and Missouri along the narrow strip of the St. Louis corridor. So what exactly are the pronunciations associated with the Inland North? The trigger for the Northern Cities shift, the vowel change that started it all, is the pronunciation of a vowels in words like bag and bad as more of an ea or a sound. So something like beag for bag. This leaves sort of a blank space where a words used to be. Then words with a vowels move into this space, giving us the well-known Chicago area pronunciation of, well, Chicago. Then the vowel in words like caught moves to where the ah words used to be, so caught the ball sounds like what the sleeping cot used to sound like, except now in the Northern Cities area, cot sounds more like cat. Meanwhile, e, as in desk, is moving toward the center of the mouth, toward dusk, and sounds more like aw. So a word like bus now sounds like boss to non-Northern ears. Are you confused yet? It's all actually very systematic and quite unconscious. Nobody in the Inland North is actually thinking about how they're pronouncing their vowels. Instead, they're following the unwritten rules that govern their language system, just like all speakers of all dialects. In the South, the rules are different. Here, words like Kate and bait now sound like kite and bite, and dress sounds like dress. At the same time, beat can sound like bait and fish like fish. Typically, as these vowels change, they're drawn out and given a little extra sound on the end, so that dress actually sounds more like dreyus and fish like fish. And it's these elongated two-part vowels, or what we call diphthongs, that lie at the heart of the so-called Southern drawl. And also the well-known pronunciation of words like ride and time as rad and tam. Geographically, the Southern vowel shift covers basically all of what we think of as the U.S. South. The dialect line doesn't exactly follow the Mason-Dixon line, but it's pretty close. It starts off between Maryland and Virginia and runs through southern West Virginia, Kentucky, southern Missouri, southern Oklahoma, and Texas. The most advanced stages of the Southern shift are found in the inland South, the Appalachian Mountain region in western North Carolina, east Tennessee, a bit of Kentucky, northwestern South Carolina, northern Georgia, and down into Alabama. The Texas South, located in north central Texas, also has a very high concentration of Southern vowel pronunciations. For example, in most Southern dialects, words like rhyme and ride are pronounced as ram and rad, but words like right and nice retain the full I sound. But in the Inland South and Texas South, we'll hear a across the board. So, as you'll remember from earlier lectures, phrases like nas white ras for nice white rice. And Southern whites use a lot more a for I than African Americans, who tend to keep it pretty confined to particular words. In African American English, there's a split, tam and tad versus right and nice. Again, this may sound complicated, but it's systematic. In African American English, I is pronounced as a before voiced consonants, but as I before voiceless consonants. This is another good illustration of the unconscious patterning of dialect rules. You don't have to know what voiced and voiceless sounds even are to follow this pattern. Chances are you didn't know what they were before listening to this lecture. But if you grew up speaking African American English or another Southern-based dialect with the same split, you internalize the pattern. So that's the Southern vowel shift and the Northern Cities shift. The Midland has always been more mixed. This is especially true the further west we move. And as you'll recall, dialect mixing often leads to dialect leveling. And so the Atlas of North American English marks out a large, homogeneous west. But the Atlas is based on a broad survey of all of North America, chiefly larger metropolitan areas. If we dig a little deeper, we find that there actually are dialect areas in the West. For example, there's long been a relatively coherent Pacific Northwest. And some newer regional dialects are springing up in the West, too, as differentiation continues. Sociolinguists have witnessed the birth of California English in the last couple of decades of the 20th century. They've documented a California vowel shift, different from both the northern city's shift and the southern shift. This time, the movement pattern involves the pronunciation of I vowels like e, so that a word like bit sounds something like bet. In turn, bet starts sounding more like bat. This is pretty different from the south, where bit sounds like beat and bet sounds like bait, and also different from the north, where bet sounds like butt. California English is also known for its a pronunciations, so backpack sounds something like backpack, and dad like dad. And its best-known vowels? Those would be oo and o in words like dude and totally. Does that sound familiar? It sounds like what we think of as Valley Girl or Surfer Dude speech, doesn't it? And actually, so-called Valley Girl speech is California English, though in somewhat exaggerated form. And it now seems to have spread well beyond California. This might be due in part to Hollywood, to movies like Valley Girl from the mid-1980s and Clueless from the mid-1990s. But the media don't always have the profound impact we might expect, and there are almost certainly other channels of influence, too. Another pronunciation associated with California English has spread throughout the U.S. and beyond, to Australia, England, New Zealand, and probably even more widely. And that's uptalk, the pronunciation of sentences so they sound like questions. Technically, this is called high-rising terminal intonation, the use of a rising rather than falling tone at the end of a declarative sentence. Typically, English speakers use a rising tone on questions, which is why we might associate uptalk with uncertainty, with doubt, and maybe even, I don't know, cluelessness? But like any other dialect pronunciation feature or grammatical feature or lexical item, uptalk is just a convention. It doesn't inherently say anything about the people who use it. It may take on connotations, but the associations are arbitrary, not real. And they can be positive, not just negative. So for some people, uptalk sounds uncertain or even stupid, but it also serves as a way of inviting people into conversation. If I frame everything like a question, I'm shaping my speech so that hopefully I'll get a response. It's just like R-dropping, same feature, different social associations, depending on who and where you are. We don't much like R-dropping in the U.S., but we used to, and Brits like R-dropping more and more. It's still spreading through the British Isles, even as it's fading rapidly from American speech. Along with increasing regional differentiation, the 20th and early 21st centuries have seen a rise in ethnic dialect distinctiveness. The civil rights movement raised ethnic consciousness and bolstered ethnic pride. At the same time, it increased the focus on ethnicity-based languages and language varieties. African American English has probably always been quite different from white American dialects. But recall that in some ways, it's become more different over the past few decades. Some of its best-known features rose to prominence in the 20th century, like the use of be to mark habitual or recurring actions, she always be working, or he be calling me day after day. Other features are more recent. For example, the use of verb forms with had to indicate past tense, not past perfect. So something like, yesterday he had called me and talked for an hour. Some ethnic dialects are even undergoing revival, just when they seem to be on the verge of fading away. One very interesting case is Cajun English. This is a variety of English that arose in Louisiana among second language speakers of French and Louisiana Creole. This particular Creole is a contact language created out of a number of different sources, several dialects of French, Native American languages, West African languages, and Spanish. Louisiana Creole and Louisiana French used to be pretty common in Louisiana, but they've gradually given way to English. But just like Creole and Cajun cuisines, Cajun English has a unique flavor. Some of its features are shared with other vernacular dialects. For example, double negatives and the use of was for all forms of past tense be, I was, you was, we was, they was. And like other dialects deriving from English as a second language, Cajun English has some different types of verb usages. For example, the use of past tense forms in infinitive constructions, as in, I wanted to drink for I wanted to drink. There are also progressive forms without ing endings, as in, I kept drank for I kept drinking. Cajun English also has pronunciation features that are associated with second language learning and with transfer from French. So, for example, tink for think and dat for that, and vowel pronunciations like face for face and bolt for boat. There's also a distinctive rhythm to Cajun English that's derived from French. Part of the rhythm involves different stress patterns. For example, the small town of Marksville is pronounced Marksville, not Marksville, by its largely Cajun population. And finally, there are English phrases that derive from the French phraseology. So, for example, making groceries for buying groceries and getting down out of the bus for getting off the bus. Now, the French language is receding in Louisiana, so you might think that Cajun English would be fading away as well. After all, many of the features of Cajun English come from second language English and from French. So once people stop speaking French, they'll stop speaking Cajun English, right? Well, yes and no. Sociolinguist Sylvie Dubois and her colleagues studied the English of three generations of Cajuns. As we might expect, they found that speakers' usage levels for features of Cajun English were lower for people in the middle age group than in the oldest generation. But quite surprisingly, when the researchers turned to the youngest group in their study, they found that Cajun English had actually sprung back up. Now, why would this be? Well, it turns out that the Cajun English linguistic renaissance corresponds with a cultural renaissance. For centuries, Cajun ethnic identity was looked down upon, even actively suppressed, and there was forced schooling in English in Louisiana beginning in the 1920s. But as the 20th century progressed, Cajun culture took on a positive value. In fact, nowadays, it even has monetary value, and you can sell your skills as a Cajun cook or Cajun musician. You can, quite literally, capitalize on being Cajun. So it makes sense that if your ethnic heritage has value to others and you take pride in it yourself, that you'd express it. And you can express it through food, through music, through styles of clothing, and through language. And even if you've lost your heritage language, you can express your identity through your ethnic dialect of English. So Cajuns have revived Cajun English. The dialect still includes transfer features from French and from second language English. But now these features are part of a native English dialect and a big part of Cajun cultural identity. The same thing happened with Yiddish language transfer and Jewish English in the 19th and earlier 20th centuries. And it's also happening today with Latino dialects of English like Chicano English in California and Puerto Rican English in New York City. People who don't even speak Spanish speak varieties of Latino English. These may sound like Spanish-accented English, but again, they're native English dialects, and they're all about community and identity, not individual linguistic background, per se. So, dialects, big and small, are a part of community identity, whether you're a Southerner, a Californian, an African American, or a Cajun American. The United States has always been a nation of diverse communities. In the early days, diversity was downplayed as the new nation developed a new American identity and presented a united front to the outside world. But once that national identity was established, Americans could begin to express their internal diversity. And that's just what we're doing now, culturally and linguistically, as our regions, ethnic groups, and communities assert their distinctiveness. But what about overseas? The English language has most definitely spread across the globe. Estimates vary, but one reliable source on world languages, called Ethnologue, lists approximately 840 million speakers of English around the world, including both native and non-native speakers. That makes it the second most spoken language in the world, after Mandarin Chinese, which has more than a billion speakers. Now, most of the world's English speakers are second language speakers. And the norm for second language English, by and large, is still British English. So in a way, not much has changed since the early 1600s, when English-speaking colonists began moving to America, but remained quite steadfastly oriented to British English. Of course, British English has changed a good bit in the past 400 plus years, but in many ways, it's still the standard for world Englishes. But American English is making some inroads. According to linguist Christian Mayer, American English lexical norms are spreading. So many English speakers around the world say elevator instead of lift and truck instead of lorry. In fact, even since the earliest days of American English, American words, Americanisms, have traveled quickly beyond American soil. They've also had quite an impact on English in England. So it's not always easy to tell whether certain words are actually American or British. Some American grammatical forms are spreading through international Englishes too, such as the regularization of irregular past tense forms, like dreamed for dreamt and learned for learnt. But pronunciation norms for international English learners are still almost always British. So if you grew up in a country like Denmark, Nigeria, or South Korea, where lots of people learn English as a second language, chances are you're going to say water, not water, and path, not path. But no matter how widespread British English-based pronunciations may be, or how popular American words are, let's not forget that wherever English spreads, it diversifies. British English has sprouted American English, Canadian English, Australian English, New Zealand English, South African English, and so on. And it continues to spawn new dialects that are quite different from more established varieties. And American English is now giving rise to new world Englishes too. Filipino English was born of American roots, not British ones, when America took over the Philippines from Spain in the late 1800s. The new American-based dialect sprang up quickly and quite purposefully. The U.S. government actively promoted American English in their new territory, for example, by installing teachers from America in Filipino classrooms. The international diversification of world Englishes continues, and so does intranational differentiation. This is true for English-speaking countries around the world, and even for England, the birthplace of the English language, and the home of its most proper standards. New dialects are still creeping up there today. One prominent example is so-called Multicultural London English, or MLE. This is a dialect created by young people living in ethnically diverse areas of London. It comprises elements of Cockney English, Jamaican Creole, South Asian Englishes, and African American English. It's sometimes disparagingly called Jafraican, since it seems unusual for kids of myriad ethnicities to use a single dialect that sounds sort of Caribbean. But it's very real. It's a full-fledged dialect, it's linguistically rich, and it serves as a strong in-group marker of identity. It's also fascinating to listen to. There are audio clips all over the internet. I recommend searching for Alistair McGowan's BBC One show on MLE for audio samples and discussion. So let's sum it all up. American English, or rather Englishes, are alive and well in the U.S. and in the world today. And just as the U.S. as a nation has changed the world's political and cultural landscape, so too has American English left an indelible imprint on the English language. At the same time, it doesn't seem likely that any one variety of English will ever crowd out the others. The spread of English across the globe has been rapid, and to friends of linguistic diversity like sociolinguists, it can seem pretty alarming. But we can't forget that English has always been and will continue to be rich in internal linguistic diversity. It's highly unlikely that the world's peoples will ever use one single language or language variety, whether American English, British English, Mandarin Chinese, or anything else. Language, dialect, and identity are inextricably intertwined, and our distinctive identities and distinctive dialects are far too important for us to ever relinquish them in favor of a single global standard.
We hope you have enjoyed these lectures from The Great Courses. Our courses are available online or via the free Great Courses app for smartphones and tablets, available on the App Store or Google Play. View our full library at thegreatcourses.com. Or as always, you can call our customer care representatives at 1-800-832-2412. Thank you very much.